So I thought we should kind of do this preview in kind of three broad parts, right? First, talking about the episodes we did last year in 2022, that's first. And then talking about what listeners can expect. We don't have everything quite planned out yet, but we have an idea of what we want to do this year, and we've lined up a few of the episodes as well. So we can talk about that in the second part. And then the third part would be some ideas, some of our personal big ideas for the coming year also that complements the reason why we did this mini series in the first place, right? So, for listeners, we're going to link in the show notes the four episodes we did last year. No, the first one was with Waterome's Chong Ti about water and water scarcity. Then we talked about with Samantha as well about marrying purpose and profit. Then the third episode was with iVisor's Wei Wen about eye care and eye health in Singapore and beyond. And then finally, we talked to Edward about finance and leaving nobody behind, right? So, thinking back on those four episodes, Samantha, what were the things that stood out to you, or what were some of the important kind of themes that came up from those discussions and conversations?
Yeah, I think one thing that really stood out to me was the idea of like truly understanding the cost of things. So I think Chong Ti talked about it in terms of like valuing the true worth of water, right? And realizing like how much water we truly spend on in our day-to-day lives, and how making small changes actually brings about a huge change in terms of the cost of water. And I think that also ties into like what Edward was talking about in terms of like not realizing how much the servicing cost is of like financing the poor, and how like reducing that goes a long way and being able to open up financial opportunities and services to the less fortunate. So I think for both of that, I think something that ties them both together was the idea that we live our lives not really realizing how much things cost and how much things value. And it's not always the same, right? We could pay for something and not realizing that we are undervaluing it, and it's actually valued so much more, or things cost less to us, but actually we don't realize that it's costing, the true cost of it is a lot more that we don't think about.
Actually, one of the things that was interesting, because I think the second episode with you, when you talk about marrying purpose and profit, the other thing that struck me in addition to the cost point was how focused they were on the purpose. So it's very much purpose driven, and it takes a lot for these different entities and individuals for them to say, oh, this is a particular thing I want to work on in the region and beyond Singapore in that sense, and to pursue them very deliberately. That takes them out of the comforts of being in Singapore in that sense, right? So clearly, when Chong Ti talks about Waterome, they've been, there was a lot of discussion about Myanmar at that point in time, which is still a challenge right now as well. Wei Wen was talking about bringing eye care and eye health to beyond Singapore in that sense. And, Edward himself talks about having partnerships in South Asia and then working on a Swiss fintech as well. And so these are folks who are beyond Singapore, but also very kind of centered by a particular purpose that they are drawn to, which is kind of striking because the purpose has to be important enough to uproot you from the comforts of Singapore in that sense and get you to go somewhere else also. Yeah. So that was something that I think came up also. Yeah. And it was something that came out through your sharing also in terms of marrying purpose and profit at that point in time also. Yeah.
Yeah, I always think that's quite interesting in the way that, like, when we first started talking about this, we wanted to like I my work is international, and so for me, like having that international aspect is always going to be important in whatever platform that I do or build. But I always think Singaporeans are really interesting to study because we grew up in a lot of ways very privileged. Like Singapore is quite safe as a country. We have a lot of amenities. The government is quite efficient, generally speaking. So it's quite comfortable compared to a lot of like developing countries elsewhere. And so I do think that it takes a certain drive to get over the inertia of the comforts of Singapore and to leave and to put ourselves in these much more uncomfortable or much more unknown situations. But I think for us that like when we do that, we end up seeing things that really leave an impact on us. And I think at that point in time, like that's where two things happen, right? One of two things happen. Either you look at it and you experience it and you think, oh wow, I'm so glad to be in Singapore. Or you think that, I have all of these privileges in Singapore. What can I do using those privileges to kind of contribute to solving this problem that I'm seeing? So I always think it's interesting. It's always been a curious question of mine, and maybe that's something we'll ask more of our guests this year, is, like why did you choose to pursue this? Or why did you decide that like to make this issue that may or may not be in Singapore, may or may not affect your own personal life, something that you want to pursue and contribute to, you know, in whatever way, shape, and form that they're doing that.
Yeah, so asking that question about purpose, also about cause or hidden cause in itself. I mean, I'll ask you the question, right, which is, do you remember the moment when you were like, there is, not that Singapore is not great, right, but there's something more beyond Singapore. I think we had this long discussion when starting up this series in terms of being intentional in talking to Singaporeans who are engaged in social initiatives in Asia and beyond, right? So I guess the question for you would be, do you remember the moment when you were like, I think I do want to venture out beyond, you know, Singapore, and then what was the experience like in the beginning for you?
I think growing up and in school, there were always like little snippets of it. So I remember when, you know, we went on a school trip to India, and this is part of like a Model UN conference. And as part of the conference, we were also volunteering with this school that provides education for kids from the slums. And, you know, so we were there, like just kind of helping the school in their programming. And we just love the fact that the kids were so like enthusiastic about learning, and, you know, they're so grateful to be in school. And I just like compared to my own experience being in school, and sometimes we don't take that, you know, we take that for granted in so many ways. And we're just like, oh, why do I have to wake up at 6 a.m. to go to school? But a lot of these kids, you know, are so grateful to be there and so excited. And I think I was very moved by that. And I think that contrast also makes me feel like, you know, it's unfair that like, I was born in Singapore. Like, I did nothing to deserve like a great education system, right? Like, I literally was just like, you know, grew up in the system. And a lot of people who were born elsewhere and grew up in different circumstances didn't have that. And I think for me, that like notion of randomness, like, you know, how your life is so much shaped a lot of times by something as random as like where you grew up, really stuck with me. And so, you know, I think that's something that's kind of always came back to me whenever I've experience something in another country that's so different from mine, that where people were subject to some disadvantages because they didn't have access to things, and that's tied to where they grew up and the circumstances that they grew up in. I think for me, the moment when I decided that I really wanted to pursue work in developing countries outside of Singapore was really when I was doing impact investing. So I was in Myanmar talking to kind of farmers in the field, and I still remember the incident where like I was talking to somebody, like a long bean farmer, and he was just saying that, you know, the work is tough, but he really enjoys it. And that, you know, ultimately he's really happy that he gets to do work that he enjoys. And so I think the flip side of, you know, that human experience is also realizing that, you know, someone can grow up in a very different experience and different environment, but our desire ultimately is the same. We all want to do work that we enjoy and find meaning in. And so to me, the idea of like difference, but also commonality on a very human level, like comes together, that makes it interesting and also a desire for me to want to like support and contribute to solving some of these like access issues in developing countries.
I guess one more question I had, and I'll give you some time while I kind of share what I think about it, is that, you know, you spoke a lot about, and our guests from the season, from the episodes last season last year, talked about how they were also informed by their background and upbringing and being rooted to some extent in Singapore as well, right? So I guess the question here would be, while doing work overseas in the region, around the world, how does that experience of having grown up in Singapore informed that? I guess for me, the way I'm thinking about it is that I, you know, came to the US to do my PhD in 2017. But even then, up to this point in time, 80-85% of my work, research or evaluation wise, still very much centered on the work we do in Singapore, right? And I mean, in that way, the pandemic was a blessing in disguise that allowed us to transition to a lot more remote, mobile style kind of working that was never possible in the past. We require you to be physically in Singapore to do field work, to research. But for me, a lot of the themes that I'm really passionate about still remain in Singapore, about poverty, about inequality, about working with families and young people from low-income backgrounds, right? And a lot of it is still centered. I'm physically based somewhere else, but my work, including this podcast in a way, and the platform with the podcast and newsletter, is still based in Singapore, right? So I guess that's a very long preamble to kind of ask you the same question, which is, how does that, you know, experience in Singapore, having grown up in Singapore, influence the way you do your work right now?
That's a really interesting one. I think for me, two things. One is that just the role of the economy, the role that the economy plays, because Singapore is such a small country and we're like always ingrained since young that, you know, human resources is very scarce but very valuable in Singapore. And so like that focus on like training talent, on spotting talent, on building talent, you know, is something that I think I take to whatever work that I do. So like even when I'm supporting entrepreneurs and founders, you know, a lot of that is also just supporting them as people and them as entrepreneurs to grow, because the belief is that, you know, when we develop them or like just like being able to leverage their talent, we're able to see big change. So that notion that like an individual person can do a lot is something that I think I take from a very Singaporean perspective. I think the other thing also is that, you know, the idea that government policy makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting for me because like I've always seen the government like fairly positively. But obviously, you know, we all have our like complaints and gripes and things that we wish the government could do better. But ultimately, like, you know, by and large, we think, like I personally think positively of the Singapore government. And so I find that, you know, when I do my work in other countries, the question is always like, how is the government faring, right? Like, how well are they doing? Is there ways to partner with them? Are there things that we need to note? Like, and I think the idea of like, not just working with the government, but also trying to figure out how can we move them into a more positive space in some of these countries too. But definitely, I think that for me, like, I'm not one to write off like the any government role in any kind of change that I want to make precisely because I grew up in Singapore. So even if like we're facing kind of like headwinds from like government policies, or always questions, always like, how can we bring them into the conversation? How can we work with them to create more favorable policies and regulations in like fintech or healthcare or whatever? So I think that's definitely something that I take with me being a Singaporean and growing up in Singapore too.
So far we've talked about, you know, the episodes from last year. We've also sought to position ourselves in terms of thinking as Singaporeans and talking to other Singaporeans who are doing social initiatives in Asia and beyond, right? So I guess it's a nice way to kind of segue into what listeners can expect in the upcoming episodes in 2023, right? We have a few lined up. So maybe let's talk a little bit about the ones that are more firm than that we have a clearer idea about. And then we can also take the chance to put out a call to folks who might know other folks are working in these spaces, and we can also do that. So we know we have an upcoming kind of two-parter that focuses on the future of philanthropy in Asia, right? So tell us a bit why, you know, kind of how we decided and focus, how we decided to focus on the future of philanthropy in Asia.
Yeah, so I think part of it was also trying to figure out where the world is right now. And so we talked a little about impact investing and kind of like nonprofits in our last year's podcast. But I think one thing that we wanted to talk about is also like the different sources of funding, of which one of the biggest one is still philanthropy. So one thing that people may not realize is that cash giving is around like $550 billion globally each year. And that's not an insubstantial amount to creating change that we want to see. At the same time, coming back to Asia, and Asia is home to more billionaires than any other continent in the world, which just like blows my mind. So according to like a Wealth Report in 2021, they estimate that like 36% of billionaires globally are in Asia. And I think there was a report that said that like over 200 billionaires are in Singapore. So yeah, for a small country, that's a lot. Yeah, and we're also just kind of seeing the Asia is seeing the fastest growth in ultra high net worth individuals between 2022 and 2026. So I think, you know, like we can't like skirt the issue of like what philanthropy is doing and how they're doing it. And so I think that's an interesting topic to bring up, especially in the Asian context, in terms of like, you know, how they see philanthropy, what they see their role, how do they choose their causes, what are some of the best practices in philanthropy. And I think that's something that would be very meaningful to talk about.
And we should also mention that both of us have some touch points with philanthropy in Asia and Singapore as well, which we will highlight to listeners when we eventually share those episodes. But I think that's a really great starting point for this year's episodes, because this is something that both of us have been involved in, and we're really excited to release that two-parter when it's ready, right? The second one would be, besides talking about the future of Asian philanthropy, would be the future of civil service and policy making, right? I mean, for folks who have been staying with us, as you shared, Sam, earlier in the episode about how your work around the world has been informed by how you perceive and evaluate the Singapore government's performance in that sense. And clearly, this is a topic that is going to be especially important, right? And also the fact that we've just come out, we're not quite out of it, right? But from the COVID-19 pandemic itself, where the government, not just in Singapore, but around the world, played an outsized role in funding social initiatives and supporting businesses and so on and so forth, right? So tell us a bit how we kind of decided to also focus on the future of civil service or policymaking in that space.
Yeah, for sure. I think one thing that's like struck me was just how much money was spent to kind of supporting people during COVID and now after COVID in terms of like creating emergency lifelines, as well as like financial lifelines for the economy. So I think if you look at the numbers, like the total is around like double digit trillions. And, you know, that goes to both direct support to people, like stimulus packages to the economy. And I think for me, just looking at the sheer quantum of money that's going into this, for me, the longer term question is like, how does that change policy making fundamentally, right? Because truth is that a lot of governments were caught off guard by COVID. So like, is there going to be more kind of like future thinking, more scenario planning? Is this something that we'll see, you know, change the way that governments interact with each other? Because I think the other interesting aspect of COVID was just how global it was too. Because we do definitely see like policymaking within countries, and a lot of like a good chunk of majority of like policymaking is intra-country. But for once, global pandemics is such that governments have to do intra-country policymaking. And so I want to see if that changes anything moving forward. I think there are things as well as also like, how much can you truly prepare for something like this, right? Like, there's always this notion of like, it's like, how much do you spend on insurance versus how much do you spend kind of just living your day-to-day life? And so I'm also curious to see how governments like allocate budgets moving forward, whether or not they set up new committees, what the committee will do. And as that COVID slowly fade into the background, whether or not we'll just go back to the old ways and old systems. Like so many people I know are back to work in person now.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. like for a while during COVID, we thought that like remote work is going to last forever.
Yeah.
But it's surprising to me how quickly people just moved back into in-person work, how quickly the world kind of moved back into what it was before. So I'm curious to know if in policymaking, that's something that will happen too.
Yeah, and which, I mean, it speaks to a few themes that we'll probably touch on in those recordings, right? The first one, which you alluded to, is the tension between globalization and protectionism, right? So, you know, the long-standing assumption is that globalization is a given, countries want and expect free flow of ideas and capital. But, you know, with certain pressures, especially between the US, between US and China and Russia right now, that comes into question, right? It's not something that we can take for granted anymore, I think. I think a second piece, which is also tied to what you mentioned in terms of how governments may potentially allocate budget, citizens and folks on the ground and communities want a greater say in that, and how governments choose to respond, whether they want to include them in the fold or different mechanisms through which we want to allow folks to be involved. In Singapore, there's an increased number in like youth panels, citizens committees, where folks can have a say in how to allocate budget to one extent or the other. I think those are going to come up in those discussions. And I think the third piece will be interesting, which is, I really like what you said in terms of whether we'll go back to business as usual, right? Because the big saying over the 2-3 years of the intense period of the pandemic was, will we learn from the lessons or will we go back to a world where a lot of these problems already existed, right? It wasn't that COVID threw up or created a bunch of new problems, it did, but it also exacerbated a lot of the existing inequalities and problems as well. And I think, you know, thinking about how civil service and policymakers deal with that would be an interesting bit also, yeah.
Yeah, and I think lastly, when we talk about the future, we can't ignore the role of technology.
Yeah.
So I think the other things that I'm excited about this year to explore is also the role of the different types of technology.
Yeah.
So things like, you know, ChatGPT is an exciting one that is moving really quickly. I was mentoring for a Stanford class the other day and just kind of mentoring students who are trying to build ideas around problems that they wanted to solve and felt passionate about. And so she was talking about how like she was doing certain research and she used ChatGPT for that. And I was like, wow, like the speed at which new technology is being taken up and adopted and becoming mainstream into people's daily lives is just blowing my mind right now. So I'm really excited to see what people think about ChatGPT, how it's going to affect, you know, things like education, whether it's a positive, whether it's a negative. I think one of my friends is an academic, also talked about how he found his first student who submitted an assignment using ChatGPT. So I think that's really interesting too. So pros and cons for sure, as with any other technology. But yeah, but I think, you know, I haven't seen anything get taken up so quickly as I've seen in the case of ChatGPT. So excited to kind of explore that too.
Yeah, and I can speak to that because I mean, being a soon to be academic in that sense, we've been having conversations about to what extent should you ban its use or how do we incorporate that? I mean, I'm personally in a camp, I'm in a latter camp, right? Which is how do we think about ways to support learning rather than pretend it's not a thing and right, trying to erase its existence. And so now, you know, when I'm developing a new syllabus for you know, social work or human development class, I'm thinking about ways in which we can fold the technology into the way we teach, right? And but clearly that's not something that everyone agrees with. And ideally that's something that we'll have a discussion about also, right? Some other topics that will come up this year, hopefully we'll get to, you know, include, you know, the future of immigrant work. It's tied into what we talked about, globalization. Another piece that I think will come up as well, and we probably should also think about, is the future of agriculture and feeding the world, which I think is wrapped up in this broader discussion about climate change and sustainable development, right? And so that's something that I think we can get to also that we really never got a chance to talk to last year, right? It might seem like a bigger, broader, wicked problem, but I think there are many cool Singaporeans based in Singapore or around the world who are doing really great work about trying to combat climate change, trying to marshal support in different ways to address the problems that we're seeing right now as well. And hopefully that's something we'll get to also.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. I mean, I obviously have a soft spot for agriculture because that's, you know, part of my background too. So agriculture is always an interesting piece for me because like we don't see a lot of it in Singapore. But actually, that's a big push. One thing that people don't realize is that Temasek is actually a big investor in agriculture initiatives worldwide just because of the food insecurity that Singapore faces. So I always thought that that connection was really interesting. Yeah, and I'm always curious to see kind of like what kind of role Singapore can play in helping to support agricultural supply chains globally and how what a bigger role we can play, especially in like climate change and the interaction between agriculture and climate change too.
So that's really neat. And so we've been really formal in this preview talking about, you know, what we learned and our personal predispositions in the 2022 episodes. We've given our folks a sense of what they can expect. And it's a long list. And we should just mention here that if folks can think about guests whom you think we should approach and include on this podcast, feel free to reach out to us. We would love to reach out to them and schedule episodes, right? But I think in this kind of final segment, in a more informal kind of note as well, think about the big ideas we might have for the coming year personally, right? So what are some of the trends and themes or ideas that we think will be of relevance in the coming year personally? So yeah, I'll let you take the first step in that sense, yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, this year has been a year of a lot of change. So I think trying to figure out how to balance the future and the present is a big one for me. So like I've always known that I wanted to do impact work, right? Impactful work, it's always meaningful for me. That's meaningful for me. It's something that's very core to who I am as a person. But I'm also entering my 30s. So I'm solidly in my 30s now. And so the idea that, okay, I need to start thinking about money and financial resources and financial stability is something that like, it's a much bigger question now than it was when I was in my 20s. I was like telling somebody the other day that like in my 20s, there was this optimism that everything will fall into place eventually and that it'll be okay as long as I'm pursuing work that I find meaningful that brings value to the world. So I think my 30s, I still have that. And I think, but at the same time, there's also a layer of like, okay, but you need to take concrete steps to make sure that you get there. There are more plans that you need to make. Yeah, so I think that's something that's on my mind a lot this year. So how can I like create my life in a way where I still get to do the work that I love, but also like have like financial resources that will build into creating the future, my personal future that I want as well. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing as well is also just being more broad. So like I'm starting to realize that there is many, many ways to solve a problem. And I think I can't just focus on a single way, or rather, even though I'm focused on a single way of solving the problem, like there is so many opportunities and so many great partnerships to be made by looking at other people who have been approaching the problem differently. And I think here being in the US is a great kind of example of that because like, you know, I'm seeped into like the startup scene, I'm seeped into technology. So I think for me, like getting excited about technology wasn't something that was part of who I was in the past, but I think definitely has been something that's been growing in me that I've been evolving towards, because I'm starting to really see kind of the potential technology when it's used right and when it's married with like policy, married with like this deep consciousness to do it for good. Yeah, so I'll say those two for now. I mean, they're pretty big as it is.
Yeah, I was going to say your second one overlaps with mine, but I think what's cool is, and the way I've heard folks frame that second point is kind of finding your tribe, right? Which is kind of finding your community in that sense. I think I've been very lucky for the last few years, especially after I started my PhD and after I came to the US, to be able to know that this is what I want to do, which is social work research and social service kind of studies in that sense as well. I would say two things as well. I'll come back to the second point, but I think the first one would be seeing things over a longer time horizon, right? So someone impressed upon me that, you know, I just turned 32 and the retirement age is what, 65, 67? That's 30, 35 years away, right? So the idea there that the person was impressing upon me was that you don't have to do all your best work right now. Sometimes I think in my 20s and in the last few years, I feel like I need to rush to produce stuff, write papers, push out things on a very fast kind of clip in that sense. But I'm realizing that often good work takes a very long time. And you know, having that longer time horizon allows me to kind of think of projects on the longer time scale, and also allows me to slow down and be able to prioritize things rather than trying to rush everything at one time. I think a second, which is connected to what you said, which is community building, right? Which is learning. I'm not there yet, but learning that you can't do everything yourself, right? So it's very tempting to feel, you know, like when I was younger, oh, I can write this op-ed, I can do this thing and it will change people's perceptions right away, right? But then I'm realizing that a lot of it comes with time, coalition building, community building, finding your tribe, finding folks who are with whom you are allied, so that you're not going at it yourself, because there's only that much that individuals can do, right? So a lot of the work right now beyond the actual research is building teams, being a part of formal teams and organizations, so that we can find the right kind of resources and leverage to work on stuff rather than trying to do everything yourself. And I think those are two big things that will stick with me, I think, personally, for the next, not just year, but I think hopefully the next decade or so. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an exciting time. When I first turned 31, I was like, oh, my 30s don't seem that different from my 20s. But now I'm like, okay, there is a significant difference. I don't think it's so much a change as much as like a layering on. It's like, you know, your onion and you're just developing a new layer on top of like whoever you already are. So I don't think it's so much of a drastic change or anything. But yeah, I think the other thing too, and maybe this will resonate with you, is the idea that because we're based in the country that's not Singapore, that's not our home country, there's also a certain deeper sense, a deeper question of like, you know, where is home going to be eventually? Like how long do I want to be in the US? Is this something that's for the long term? You know, like also something in the midterm future and eventually want to go home. So I think that's the other thing too, like balancing family, balancing my own aspirations, balancing what home feels like and what home means to me. And I think that's also a great way to tie back to, you know, one of the first questions you asked me in this podcast, which is like, you know, how does being Singaporean and growing up in Singapore change and fed into the work that I did? And it's funny because I never thought of that question. And I honestly never thought that it did until, you know, I was answering your question, until you asked me that. So I think that's also fascinating to me.
Yeah. And I'm just going to say the final thing I'll say is that something we should probably do is that once we've recorded this year's episodes at the end of the year or the beginning of next year, we can come back to this and kind of get a sense of where we've been. I know it's a one year is short in the context of a longer time frame, but it would be nice to kind of reflect and review what we've done. Because I would just say that it's been really fun doing the four episodes with you. And I think you share my enthusiasm that we have really great guests coming up and episodes to discuss and something we'll work on. And I'm excited for folks to listen to those episodes that will come up at some point. Yeah.
Sounds good, Ting Yao. So well, you know, I'm excited about the episode. So are you. I hope our listeners are too. Once again, want to interview if there's anything in particular that, you know, our listeners want us to cover or the guests that you think would be exciting to have on this podcast, you know, definitely reach out to us. Yeah, we love chatting with guests. I think we get a lot of energy from kind of hearing their thoughts and their vision of what the future could be or they would like to be. And it's always nice to kind of spend a little bit of moments like kind of creating that space.